Now we kind of, I want us to kind of look back a little bit here and just kind of a quick little recap to how we got to chapter 16. And we need to remember that Saul, who was the first king, he was rejected in Gilgal because of his unlawful sacrifice in Gilgal. As a matter of fact, in 1 Samuel 13:13, it says, "And Samuel said to Saul, 'You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart.'" And I'm here to tell you right now, he's still looking for that. And he's constantly looking for a man and or a woman and many men and women to have a heart after him. He is continually looking for that. When we get introduced to Saul, we get to introduced by to Eli and Samuel, but it's right after this chapter, after Saul is disqualified in a sense, that we get introduced to Jonathan in chapter 14. Now, before all this, before we meet Jonathan in chapter 14, there's an interesting pattern that seems to be happening here. There's this pattern that the biological son does not replace his father. Instead, we see the biological son being replaced by what is we see as an adopted son. Eli, the high priest, his sons are unfaithful. They get replaced by Samuel. Samuel also, his sons show unfaithfulness. And so now that gets replaced by Saul, who is to now lead the people. And so there seems to be this pattern that the biological son does not replace his father. Instead, there's a replacement there, an adopted son. So here in chapter 14, we're introduced to a guy by the name of Jonathan, who is Saul's son. And so we look at him, and we see here that no sooner do we see Jonathan as a son of Saul, that we also learn that he's been disinherited. He's not going to be the next king. And the bummer to that is the fact that Jonathan is every bit his name, a gift from God. Jonathan is a godly guy. And yet because of his dad, he's not going to inherit the kingdom. And so it has nothing to do with the unfaithfulness of this son. We see Jonathan, he's very bold and aggressive, full of faith in God's strength. And yet, he's not going to be the next king. He's not going to be the next king. So instead of seeing Jonathan as the next king, the replacement for Saul, we see instead, we're going to see Jonathan befriend this young man by name of David, and he's going to yield to the will of God over his right to the throne. And there's a lot of similarities between Jonathan and David, as we shall see. With Jonathan, we see he's the actual son of Saul, but later on, we're going to see that David becomes the son-in-law to Saul. We also see with Jonathan how he leads Israel to victory over the Philistines in 1 Samuel 14. But we're also going to see David lead Israel to victory over the Philistines in 1 Samuel 17. Twice, Saul himself attacks his own son, Jonathan. We see that in chapter 14 where he says, because you partook and ate of the honey and things like that, you're going to die, and the people rescue him. Later on, we see that Saul actually casts a spear at Jonathan in chapter 20, verse 30 through 34. We also see that Saul attacks David twice by throwing a spear at him in 1 Samuel 18 and 1 Samuel 19. And we also see that Jonathan actually trusts God, not an army, in a battle that he has in 1 Samuel 14. And we also see David trust God, not an army, when he battles Goliath. And so we see these amazing similarities here. Jonathan is very much an amazing example of a godly man who resists any sort of jealousy or envy in knowing that David is going to be the next king, the one that's chosen by God. And you know what? He's fine with it. He's fine with it. His calling, he sees, is to support David to become king. And instead of fearing and hating David, we're told in 1 Samuel 18 that he loves David. Instead of being jealous when he heard of David's exploits being praised, Jonathan joins in on praising David. And so we're going to be able to glean a lot from Jonathan as we go over these next few chapters. Jonathan is a godly, godly guy. And he's just a wonderful man of God. Now, what you might not know is that there is a huge age difference between Jonathan and David. A huge age difference. According to 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 4, David became king when he was 30 years old. And according to the book of Acts chapter 13, Saul reigned for 40 years. Thus, David was born in the 10th year of Saul's reign, if that's the case. And yet, Jonathan was already fighting in the third year of Saul's reign in the Battle of Michmash. Because it says in 1 Samuel 13, verse 1, Saul reigned 1 year. When he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash in the mountains of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. So, if Jonathan was 20, and I would submit to you he was probably older than that. But let's just say, for argument's sake, he was 20. That would make him 27 years older than David. Jonathan could have been his father. Jonathan could have been his father. And so, I just wanted you to kind of get the background of that as we jump into here in chapter 16. As we left off a few weeks ago, probably more like a month ago, God and Samuel were mourning over the unfaithfulness of Saul. It says in 1 Samuel 15:35, and Samuel went no more to see Saul until the day of his death. Nevertheless, Samuel mourned for Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. That's an interesting word, that God himself regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. In verse 11 of chapter 15, it says, I greatly regret. You know? And so people like to point that out and try and maybe show that God is learning. It's called the openness of God and things like that. And he doesn't really know everything that's going on. And some will even go as far as that even he makes mistakes and he regretted even making Saul king. And that's not true. It's not true at all. This is the reason why he uses these words is known as anthropomorphism. And that's God explaining himself to man in using human terms. So man can have a better understanding of what's going on in God's heart and how he feels about things. God obviously knew from the beginning of Saul's heart. He knew Saul's ways. He knows his destiny. As a matter of fact, we already read he was seeking a man after his own heart, even before he had mentioned this. And so what is being said here is that God's not emotionless, okay? He feels things as well. It's not as though he's sitting in heaven with a clipboard just checking up boxes, okay, waiting for Saul to fail here and here. Okay, on to the next guy, David, okay? It still grieves him. Saul's disobedience still hurt God. And since we couldn't understand what was really happening in God's heart, the closest that we can come is for God to express it in human terms, saying, I greatly regret that I've set up Saul as king. It's really to show how much Saul blew it. If God is going to regret about something about you, that just shows how badly you have blown it and how far away from God you've actually walked. Our unfaithfulness grieves God. Our unfaithfulness hurts God. In my devotion this week, I'm in Ezekiel, and I came upon this verse in Ezekiel chapter 6. God's explaining through Ezekiel why Israel is going to be scattered among the nations. And he says, they're going to be scattered among the nations because I was crushed by their adulterous heart, which has departed from me. Can you imagine that? They crushed his heart. It speaks of the hurt that he feels because of all the things he has done and all the privileges he's given them in knowing who he is and giving them the law and being there and doing all these miracles before him and trying to invite them into this relationship that they can have with the living God. And yet they continually to rebel and they departed from him and it crushed him. The Bible says it crushed him. God was crushed by their adulterous heart. Our unfaithfulness, when we depart from God and his ways, it crushes him as well. And we do that when we go after the things of the world compared to the things that he tells us to do. That crushes him. It hurts God. And so God is only going to mourn over Samuel for a time. And when it's time to move forward, it's time to move forward. And so Saul has been mourning as well. And so here in 1 Samuel 16, verse 1, it says, and now the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I am sending you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided myself a king among his sons. So he just told him, you're going to find the next king, son of Jesse. It's going to be a son of Jesse. So it's time to anoint the new king, a faithful king, a king after God's own heart. Get up, Saul. Stop mourning. It's now we have to look forward. We got to go towards the future now. Fill your horn. I'm sending you to the house of Jesse in Bethlehem. And so this new king of Israel is going to be found among his sons, the sons of Jesse, which, by the way, Jesse was the grandson of Ruth and Boaz. And so here in verse 2, it says, and Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me. But the Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Then invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do, and you shall anoint for me the one I name to you. Now, is God telling Samuel to lie? He's not, because this was true. Samuel did offer a sacrifice, and he couldn't really do the work that was required of him by God unless he offered this sacrifice. And so, yes, it gave him an excuse to go, but he would have had to have done this anyway if he's going to anoint the next king of Israel. And so he calls the elders of the people together and this collection of Jesse's sons. And it says in verse 4, so Samuel did what the Lord said and went to Bethlehem. And the elders of the town trembled at his coming and said, do you come peaceably? Now, why do you think they're trembling at his coming? You remember what happened at the end of chapter 15? You remember chapter 15? How Saul was called to kill the Amalekites, you know? He was supposed to kill all of them, and he doesn't do that. And so because he doesn't do that, he brings back the king of the Amalekites, Agag. And he said, and instead of going and killing all of them and killing all their animals and things like that, they bring back the best of the sheep and the cattle. And so Samuel goes to him, what did you do? I've accomplished the will of God. I've done exactly what he said to do. No, you haven't. I hear the bleating of the sheep. I hear the braying out there of donkeys. I hear the mooing of the cattle. I hear all this stuff. Well, the people did that. We thought it was best to bring back the best to worship to your God. You fool. You're proving right now you do not have a heart after God. That you will usurp what God says and do what you think is best. That's not a man or a woman after God's own heart. And he tells him, he says, the kingdom has been torn from you this day. And so he brings Agag, the king of the Amalekites, and he hacks him to pieces right there. Now, for whatever reason, that probably got out that Saul was or Samuel was pretty upset about the whole thing. He comes walking into Bethlehem, and the elders want to know, have you come peaceably? I mean, I still don't get it to a degree, just because it's kind of like, dude, he hacked up, you know, an enemy king. Are you his enemy? What are you worried about? I don't know. We heard he's really moody. I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking. But he says, no, I come peaceably. And so I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Sanctify yourselves. Come with me to the sacrifice. Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. Now, when an animal is sacrificed to atone for sins, the whole animal is offered to the Lord and burnt up to the Lord, and there's nothing left over for you to feast upon. But when an animal is sacrificed as a peace offering, a fellowship offering, or a consecration offering, which this is, then part of the animal is burnt before the Lord. Part of it is eaten in special ceremonial meal. And so this is what this feast was about here. So the elders and Jesse and his sons were there, and they participated in this meal. And so the idea was not for Jesse and his sons just to watch. They're going to participate. They're part of this meal. And we're going to see here that during this meal, but David's not there. David's not there for that meal. It kind of shows how Jesse and the rest of his family kind of viewed David. He's not worthy to be at this feast. He's not worthy that the high priest has come in and is going to consecrate, you know, this animal. There's going to be a feast. David's not invited. And then later on, when they find out he's actually there to anoint a king, they don't invite David to that either. So it gives you a little bit of an understanding of how they view David. He's just this little pipsqueak, you know, he's still young. He's out there, you know, just watching the sheep. And he doesn't need to be at this. And so it says in verse 6, it says, "And so it was when they came that he looked at Eliab and said, 'Surely the Lord's anointed is before him.' But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not look at the appearance or at his physical stature, because I refused him. For the Lord does not see as a man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" Actually, it's Eliab. And so they look at Eliab. Eliab looks like a perfect specimen of a king, but it's kind of like, Samuel, don't fall for that again. We already gave you a guy named Saul who is head and shoulders above everybody else, a very good-looking guy, a guy that you think is full of confidence. Certainly this is a guy to lead you. And he looks at Eliab and he says, kind of feels the same way. He goes, certainly this is the guy right here, of course. And the Lord just tells him, don't look at the outward. Don't look at the outward appearance or his physical stature, because I refused him. For the Lord does not see as a man sees. The man that for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. I love that. And yet, we quite often, as people who are looking for someone to lead the Lord's people or a minister or something like that, we sometimes still look for the most talented person, the most eloquent of speakers, to be able to teach and lead people in ministry. And yet, that's not what we should be looking for. We should be looking for somebody who has a heart after God. Because you have a heart after God, you're really going to have a heart after God's people. Oh, they may be good at what they do. They might be very, very talented. But what is going to be revealed probably sooner rather than later is that they're really a Saul. Alan Redpath says this: "Sometimes we covet attractive and talented people for the Lord's work, but they turn out to be heartaches because they are not among God's chosen. The basis of God's choice is contrary to all this. When he would build a man of God, he looks for a different timber." I love that. We think this is the best timber right there, and God's saying, no. This is the makeup of the man that I want. This is the makeup of the woman that I want. And he looks differently than we look for. We look at the outward, he looks at the heart. It's kind of like what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, that he has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, the weak things of the world to confound those things which are mighty. And why does he do this? So no flesh can glory in his presence. That's why. So you'll know that's the Lord. That's the Lord. And he will get all the glory. God is looking for a heart that loves him and loves his people. And God will use that heart to lead his people. And so Jesse calls Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. And then Jesse made Shema pass by and he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. Thus Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. And Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. And yet Samuel was sent by God saying, it's going to be one of the sons of Jesse. And Samuel says to Jesse, are all the young men here? Notice he's beginning to clue into something here. Here's all your sons, and yet God said no to all of them, yet God said I'm supposed to choose one of your sons. This tells me, are all your sons here? And then he says, well, there remains yet the youngest, as in to say, certainly it can't be him, you know. And there he is, keeping the sheep. Again, kind of in a degrading manner. He's the youngest, and he keeps the sheep. Look, like right there, come on. And he says, Samuel says, Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not sit down till he comes here. So he sent and brought him in, and now he was ruddy with bright eyes and good looking. And the Lord said, arise and anoint him, for this is the one. Then Samuel took the horn of oil, anointed him in the midst of his brothers. The Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel rose and went to Ramah. Now, a couple things here. What do you think was going through David's mind? What do you think he was thinking? He comes in. He probably doesn't even need to be introduced to Samuel. He probably comes in and goes, whoa, that's Samuel. That's the high priest. Wow. I wonder what his brothers were thinking. Were they excited for David? Were they jealous and angry? I would submit to you that they were the latter there. We will see that more when David comes to fight Goliath. They kind of despise him, thinking that he just wants to see the action and, you know, things like that. You could just feel the disdain in his brothers' voices. And so it's kind of like, then Samuel says, David, I need for you to kneel right now. What? He kneels, pulls out the horn of oil, pours it upon his head. David would have known what that meant. Why am I being anointed? They do this with kings and prophets. No doubt Samuel probably prayed over him, maybe even prophesied over him. The text doesn't tell us. But he did that with Saul when he anointed him. I would think that he would probably have done the same thing with David. What was going on here? What is going through David's mind? I'm the least of all my father's sons. I'm out being a shepherd. This is not where kings come from. But God tells us something different. He's saying, yep. And this is what makes a king someone who has a heart after mine. Never underestimate what God can do through a vessel that surrenders to him and truly loves him. David was able to spend a long, long time contemplating, meditating on the things of God, because to be quite honest, there's not a whole lot to do when you're looking after sheep. They kind of sit there and kind of get into trouble. They'll wander off. But then when you kind of get them collected, they're content and they're actually eating the grass or the pasture you have them in, you're just kind of hanging out. And we're told from the Psalms that David did a lot of thinking. And he did a lot of thinking and meditating on the things of God. I want you to go to Psalm 19. He's out there watching sheep. David meditates on the Lord. It's the reason why he's able to write Psalm 19 is because of all those evenings that he's been out at night watching the sheep. In Psalm 19, he contemplates the greatness of God, the creator of the universe that spoke of his awesome power. David thought and meditates on this, and it says in Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. Somewhere along the line, as he's looking up, he realizes there's a creator. How anybody cannot understand that there's a creator, that there's a master designer out there. David's gone, I understand it, and I'm just a little sheep herder. It amazes me what sometimes someone who is very, very young could understand at a very young age, and that you could be talking to somebody who's a PhD and they don't get it. It's one of the reasons why quite often I refer to PhD as piled high and deep. Because the lacking of common sense, of understanding that is so plain for everybody to see. Here, David, the shepherd, is able to look up into the heavens and go, the heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech. And you know what it utters? I am is what it utters. And night unto night reveals knowledge. You can see how powerful he is. You can see how organized he is. You can see all sorts of things about God when you just stare up into the heavens and look at the stars and notice how the sun comes up every day and the moon and all that. You can learn a lot. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. It's deafening that God says, I am, through the heavens. Their line has gone out through all the earth and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like the bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoiced like a strong man to run its race. And it's speaking of the constellations and where they are through their seasons and things like that. It is rising from one end of heaven and its circuit to the other end, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. He didn't get that from looking up at the stars. He got that because his family obviously went to the sanctuary. His family, Jesse, obviously taught the Word of God. And what that tells me is that David is listening. And he believes what is being spoken to him by the rabbi as he goes to the sanctuary there. And so we look at this and we just kind of go, wow, David's been listening. Not only is he contemplating when he sees the creation all around him, but he's believing the words that are being spoken to him. The Torah, the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, that's being shared, and he hears this history of how they came out of Egypt. He believes. And he believes in the commandments of God, and he believes in all that God has spoken to his people. David believes. And he gets to meditate on this while he's out there looking out after the sheep. And it's just burying deeper and deeper into his heart. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are than gold, yea, than much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey in the honeycomb. He's saying, you know what? God's word is more valuable than what the world says is a value. He's already gotten this at a very young age. Moreover, by them your servant is warned, and in keeping them there is great reward. Who can understand his errors? Cleanse me from my secret faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me, then I shall be blameless. And I shall be innocent of great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight. O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. David here actually believes that God knows him better than he knows himself. And he desires nothing more than to be with God. He desires nothing more than to meditate on his precepts and his laws and his commandments. He sees them more valuable than anything the world has to offer. But he also knows that by going wayward, by departing from the Lord, will separate him from God. And that God knows him better than he knows himself. And so he's even asking him, cleanse me from my secret faults. Show me myself. Show me who I am. Where is that chink in the armor? Because I believe you know me better than I know myself. And he says, I want to be acceptable in your eyes. So even keep me back from presumptuous sins. And so he's asking here, let the words of my mouth and meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and redeemer. It means he has to be redeemed from something. And he understands he's a sinner. Even in the midst of his contemplation and doing the very best he can and trying to get to know God, he understands he's still a sinner. Cleanse me from my secret faults. When have you ever prayed that? I don't pray that very often because I'm so well aware of the faults that aren't secret. You know? Those other things are so glaring. There's just no time in the day to pray for my secret faults, you know? It's kind of like, oh, Lord, I already know what I need to pray for. You've made that abundantly clear, so I'm just going to pray for this, pray for this, pray for this. But have you ever gotten to that point where you actually say, Lord, I'm asking you to reveal my secret faults that I'm not even aware of? I think it's a good prayer to pray. This is the making of a king right here. Contemplating the word of God, meditating. It's burying down deep. You're able to look at his creation, give him praise and glory, and understand his mighty, his power, his majesty when he looks out into the heavens. I want you to go to Psalm 23 now. Oh, Oh, believe me, there's many psalms we can go to that David wrote that you get a gist that he came to this place while he was out there and he had a lot of time to just meditate on the Lord. But Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Who better to write and see God as a shepherd more than a shepherd himself? He understands what it is to be a shepherd. He understands he's the one that has to look after the sheep, that the sheep aren't looking at him going, dude, where's the grass? Hey, we're thirsty here. The sheep never have to do that with a good shepherd. The good shepherd knows when to bring him into this field and to bring him over here and to walk him over here so they get something to drink. The shepherd takes care of all that. And David equates his God as my shepherd. I shall not want. What David is saying here is that I trust that God knows what's best for me. Amazing. And because of that, I'm not going to want anything. Because God knows what's best for me. And then he says, he makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. David understands the joy of having communion with God. He had this meditative heart with God. And it says, he makes me. He brings me to the place which is the very best thing for me. And if I'm hedging and hawing at all, he will get me there anyway. He will make me get there. And he leads me beside still waters. It speaks of a reflective pond. It speaks of a place that you can go and drink and truly reflect upon all that God is doing. He restores my soul. He leads me to the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And David understands that not only is God my shepherd, I don't need to want for anything. He's going to do what's best for me. He understands the reason why God's going to do that. It's for his name's sake. It's not about David. It's about God. And he understands that. If only more of God's people would understand that anything that they go through, anything and everything, that it's for his name's sake, I'm pretty sure we would stop asking the question, why? Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. David is very, very confident, no matter what horrors or evils come his way, that the Lord is with him. And this is not a David confidence, this is the God confidence. Because later on, when he's explaining to Saul of why he wants to fight Goliath, he says, look, God is with me. I have fought the bear and the lion, and God has delivered me from both of them. He doesn't say, and I was really savvy and I was able to do this. He says, God delivered me. And just like God delivered me from the bear and the lion, he's going to deliver me from Goliath. God's going to do it. Because he's seen him do this before. And Goliath is no different. He's just as ugly as the bear and the lion. He doesn't even growl as loud. And so he's very confident with that, but it's a God confidence. It's not a self-confidence. Verse 5 says, you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. The heart of gratitude that David has, knowing that it was the Lord that anointed him for this. He didn't deserve it. He didn't pull him up by his own bootstraps to get where he is. He sees this as truly the divine favor of God. And it keeps him humble. My cup runneth over. It's overflowing. I can't even contain all the blessings that you've done for me. This is somebody who has a very thankful heart. And this has nothing to do with things. It has to do where your heart is. My cup runs over. I'm just overjoyed of all the things that God has done for me. That's David. And David wasn't like this naturally, as we'll see here in a moment. But verse 6 says, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, for I will dwell in the house of the Lord God forever. David even believes the future. When this kingdom thing's all done and I'm done being king and everything else, and when I go die, I get to be with God forever. And again, this attitude did not come naturally, because in Psalm 51:5 he says, behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. He understands that he was a sinner. He came to this place. As he listened to the truths of God, as he listened as people spoke about God and where they came from, and he's out there and he sees the grandeur and the majesty of God, and he begins to contemplate on all those things that he's being taught and what he's read, and he came to this place. God is so good. God is so good. And somewhere during this time out in the fields looking after those sheep, David, he meets God. He spends time with God. And by doing that, David got to know God. And this was always David's desire, to know God, to have fellowship with God, to dwell in the house of the Lord forever. That's why he has a heart after God. Because that's what God wants himself, is to have fellowship with us, that we would dwell with him forever. Hence why David had a heart after God. He wants the same thing God wants, fellowship, being with us forever. So how old do you think David is at this time when he's getting anointed as king? I want you to get out of your mind the whole VeggieTales thing, okay? All your Sunday school, you know, of seeing David as a very, very small person and things like that. Josephus says that David was 10 years old. Others guess around 12, 13, 14. That's all very, very possible. That's very possible. It doesn't tell us how old he was. We have a tendency to think that he's like 10, 11, 12 years of age. I don't think that that's biblical. Because nowhere does it say that he was a really, really small child when this took place. As a matter of fact, what we do is we usually go to chapter 17 when he's about to fight Goliath. Goliath looks at him with disdain in verse 42. Of chapter 17, and says, "And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and good looking." So that's the only place that we have of to try and figure out how old David was. Now, the interesting thing about that word youth, it's the Hebrew word nahar, it is used as the infant Moses in Exodus chapter 2, verse 6. And I'm pretty sure he wasn't an infant when he fought Goliath. But it's also used in 2 Samuel chapter 18. I want you to go there. And look who they call the same name. In 2 Samuel 18. Verse 32. And the king said to the Cushite, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" So the Cushite answered, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise against you to do harm be like that young man. He's dead." This is after the coup that Absalom does to try and get his father's throne, his kingdom. Most people believe that Absalom was probably between 30 and 40 years of age when this happened. And yet it uses the same word there, young man. So, granted, and I would grant this as well, David is the one that's saying this. And the way he says that is kind of like, is my baby boy okay? Okay? So because it comes from David, I make the argument of going, well, you can't say that this word is speaking of from like the age of an infant all the way to a 35 or 40-year-old man. Because David is the one that uses that term. And that would be a term, if you ask me, of a term of endearment. My son is always going to be my son. My son is always going to be my baby boy. My girl is always going to be my baby girl. And so he could say it in such a way, is my young son okay? Is my young son okay? He's not a young son, but he is, you know, if you're 70, you know, and you're inquiring about your son. To him, he's young. And so, but there are those who say it could be anywhere from, you know, an infant all the way to this, and so we don't really know how to really use that word. And I understand that. It's just that you have to understand who said that. If somebody else had said that other than David himself, I would have said, okay, they're drawing this conclusion that he would still fit in that category. But I look at it as David is saying that about his son, and he's kind of looking at him as he's always going to be my son, my young son. So we don't really know how old David is. We don't know at all. We don't know because a lot of things happen here in the next probably, you know, 56 verses or so that really lead things to where you have to really look into this and say, does this make sense? Does this make sense? Because we don't really know. Because as we continue on here, it tells us this. It says in verse 14, but the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him. Now, I would submit to you that from verse 13 and 14, that probably a good amount of time has passed. To which you can say, well, why do you say that? Well, we'll continue on here. But the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him. And the Saul's servant said to him, surely a distressing spirit from God is troubling you. Now, a lot of people struggle with this because they say, well, if a distressing spirit of the Lord came upon and troubled Saul, then God is sending something evil to someone. The word evil spirit here, distressing spirit, the word distressing actually does mean evil. It's the word ra. It also means familiar spirit. That is speaking of a demon of some sort. So if God is all good, why does he send a distressing spirit upon Saul? There are two senses in which God may send something. He may send something in an active sense where he sends it, or in an active sense where he is behind it and he's the one that sends it, or he can send something in a passive sense, meaning he has allowed it. So when God takes his protection away from Saul, Satan can then come in there and cause problems. And I personally am one who adheres to that more than anything else. Passively, God may withdraw the hand of protection and therefore allow evil to come without being the source of the evil itself, much like he did with Job. Okay, Satan has to go before him. Can I do this? Can I do that? It would have been the same thing with Saul, and God would have said, yes, you may. Now, I want you to pick up on something here. It says here in verse 16, it says, let our master now command your servants who are before you to seek out a man who is a skillful player on the harp, or the lyre is really what that is. And it shall be that he will play it with his hand when the distressing spirit from God is upon you. You shall be well. So that tells me that that they have found music to be soothing to the tortured soul. Okay? I don't think that they just kind of made that up. Hey, maybe this will work. It seems like they have a plan. This is what is going to help you. Now, the interesting thing is this is the first time that you see an evil spirit. This is the first time that an evil spirit comes into play into God's word to where you go, whoa, there's those powers and principalities there. And so he says then, and so Saul said to his servants, provide me now a man who can play well and bring him to me. Okay. Then one of his servants answered and said, look, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing, a mighty man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech, a handsome person, and the Lord is with him. Therefore Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, send me your son David, who is with the sheep. Interesting. So he's talking about David. Somehow this servant has seen David play the lyre. And he calls him a mighty man of valor. And he also calls him a man of war. Prudent in speech and a handsome person. Now, where could this guy have possibly, for one, heard him play the lyre? for two, be able to call him a man of valor, a man of war, skillful in speech. Where are you going to see a 13, 14-year-old boy be able to do that and come to that conclusion? I would submit to you between verses 13 and 14, and even though a distressing spirit is upon him, it doesn't mean that immediately when that spirit comes upon him that they develop this plan or idea. We don't know if months went by before that distressing spirit went upon him. We don't know if a year or two has gone by. But there has to have been enough time that has gone by for this servant to have been able to see David in some sort of situation where he could have called him all those things. Unless the servant is just prophesying without knowing it. And that, by the way, I don't take off the table. That's a possibility as well. That's a possibility as well. But what happens here is that it says, send me your son David who is with the sheep. So, Saul does call him at this time. David is with the sheep. David is with the sheep. And Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread and skin of wine and a young goat and sent them by his son David to Saul. So David came to Saul and stood before him, and he loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. Just so you know, 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old boys don't become an armor bearer. Armor bearers go into battle with you. Okay? They go into battle with you. And you're not going to want some inexperienced rookie going into battle with you. You just don't. Now, it does say became his armor bearer. It doesn't mean he became the armor bearer the moment he showed up. So let's look at it that way as well. Okay? Then Saul sent to Jesse saying, please let David stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight. And so it was, whenever the Spirit from God was upon Saul, that David would take a harp, play it with his hand, and then Saul would become refreshed and well, and the distressing spirit would depart from him. So David has the Spirit of the Lord. So when the Spirit of the Lord shows up, the demon leaves. David is a type of the Messiah who is to come. We know that Jesus is the Messiah that comes from the Son of David. I find it interesting the very first time we see any sort of evil spirit or distressing spirit or some demonic spirit, it's with David, who has the Spirit of God, that when he comes in, that spirit is going to leave. And then we see Jesus later on come and does things that nobody's ever done before, that even the demons believe in him. Even he has authority even over the demons, Jesus does. We'll get more into this next week. I really want you to pray about it. I really want you to study this on your own. But is it a possibility that Israel, when it came to training men of war, that they have some training sessions? Maybe some, as kids are getting older, as they're becoming 15, 16 years of age, is there a time where they go off for a little bit and they train because they know, and look at all the rest of David's brothers, they're in the army, they're of Saul, that they're being trained during this time to be men of war. Maybe David has gone to a skirmish or two. But it's kind of temporary. They go back. They have to take care of their family. He's still a keeper of the sheep. Has he had some training at this point? Has this servant somehow been able to view David with this young group of soldiers, seen him in battle, seen his heart, seen him come back, play the harp to up the morale and encourage the other soldiers, and then also speak the words of God? Is there a possibility of that? I think there is. Because this understanding that David fought Goliath as a young, young man, being 10, 11, 12, 13 years of age, is not true. And if you read the account, people said, well, you know, Saul's armor didn't fit him. It doesn't say it didn't fit him. It just said he hadn't had a chance to test it, is what it says. It doesn't say it didn't fit him. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure that Saul, if David was 2 feet, you know, shorter than him and weighed 130, you know, wouldn't have said, "Hey, let me try my armor on you." True? That would make absolutely no sense. So he's probably somewhat the same size. And if he wasn't, he would have said, "Okay, somebody else give him your armor." Saul's just trying to give him the best for him, but he hasn't tested it. He hasn't worked out in it. You know, that's the reason why he says, "No, this isn't going to work for me." And so he wasn't 11, 12, 13 years of age here. We don't know how old he is. But I just find it interesting that this guy is able to see, he has seen for himself him being able to play the lyre. He's obviously seen him in some sort of combat. Call him a man of valor, a man of war. And yet, eloquent speech. Observe this as he was taking care of the sheep. So I just kind of throw that out to you. What's that all about?